Hello and welcome to The Rufus Project, your fortnightly guide to whatever geeky, pop culture-y movie thing is grabbing our attention at the time. I'm your host, Trevor Holland, and I will be joined by my good friend, co-host, and king of cult cinema in Brisbane, Christian Fletcher, very, very shortly. But what do we have in store for you this time around? I'm going to have a look at some of the big reveals from San Diego Comic-Con and make a few guesses as to what we might expect when the things finally hit our screens. Christian celebrates the upcoming 58th birthday of musical icon Kate Bush with a bit of a retrospective of her music and career. While we don't have an interview this time around, Christian and I do have a great chat about cinema remakes. Of course, we've got the geek news coming up and some of those upcoming events that Christian is hosting. Well, that's enough talk about what's coming up. How about we actually get on with this podcast? Enjoy. I guess it's time for a little bit of news. First up, upcoming Aussie ISP YourNet has announced that it will have inbuilt circumvention measures for geo-blocking when it launches in Australia. That means that it will automatically let you access things like US Netflix, Hulu, BBC iPlayer, the whole box and dice. Of course, the concern is that a number of ISPs in New Zealand offered a very similar service. It was more like an add-on service. This is meant to be built in, where they did that, and that's recently been shut down because of large-scale legal action by various rights holders from around the world who were very concerned about the ability to bypass these restrictions because they're all a bunch of dinosaurs. Will be interesting to see how this goes with YourNet. Foxtel, of course, has already announced that they're going to keep a close eye on this service when it launches, see the impact before deciding what action to take, but I think it's pretty safe to assume they're going to take action, because they're also a bunch of dinosaurs. In a bit of an interesting gaming science crossover, that New Horizon probe that's been sending us those lovely images of Pluto, that is awesome, I found out is actually being powered by the same processor that was in the PlayStation 1. That's right. It is being powered by technology that is now 12 years old. But hey, look, if it's reliable and it works, all good. Obviously, it's working out pretty well for NASA, so good job. I think I'm going to have to give my PS1 a little bit of a congratulatory pat. A bit of competition for the clever geek, this podcast. First up, we have Nissan's Twitter representative, who mistook screen grabs from the PlayStation title Drive Club for actual photos of Nissan cars, praising the quality and how good they looked. He quickly backed down when it was revealed that they were in fact in-game shots, with the comment, "Graphics these days are ridiculous." However, he was beaten at the last minute by Warner President of Worldwide Marketing, Sue Kroll. You see, over the past weekend at San Diego Comic-Con, the Suicide Squad trailer was shown to Hall H attendees, and it wasn't meant to go beyond that. But of course, this is the digital age. People got footage on their smartphones, Warner Brothers spent several days trying to plug all the leaks that were going out, and finally released the trailer for general viewing, which you think would have been a pretty much a no-brainer, because you know, trying to squash exclusive footage in the past has worked out so well for people. However, what she has said that the anti-piracy team has been working tirelessly to contain that footage. Okay, they consider this piracy, and they consider that this movie that has had so much buzz and already has had a number of leaks of images and footage getting out there. I mean, seriously, this mentality has got to change, and Sue Kroll, for calling the release of what is essentially a publicly available trailer piracy? I mean, really, you were trying to contain this so the buzz would build, and your marketing could go haywire. But of course, they didn't want the film misrepresented by the poor quality of the footage taken within the hall. Yeah, that is rubbish. We know it's rubbish. You know it's rubbish. Can the marketing speak? join the modern world. And for that, Sue Kroll, you are this podcast's clever geek. Well, San Diego Comic-Con has been and gone, and it's certainly brought with it its fair share of reveals. Some pretty amazing, some pretty much expected. What I thought we'd do is have a quick look at three of the biggest ones, in my book anyway. You may disagree, but hey, it's my podcast. And have a bit of a breakdown of what we saw, what we think, and what we guess. We'll start with DC's big gun, Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice. DC released the full trailer for this upcoming movie, and in it, there's a few surprises and a few things left to guess. We finally get to see Jesse Eisenberg in action as Lex Luthor, and we see a lot more of Ben Affleck both in and out of that bat costume. They've clearly put in a section there about Batman's origin story. There is a very clear shot in the trailer of Thomas and Martha Wayne being murdered in the alleyway, like we have to see with every single thing that we ever have involving Batman. We all know this, guys. Just don't make it too long. Another big highlight of this trailer is we get our first good look at Wonder Woman, both incognito as Diana Prince and in action. We only see brief snippets, and there is absolutely no connection as to her involvement with everything else that's going on. So I guess you gotta wonder why she's there. Yeah, Wonder Woman, Wonder... Yeah, don't worry about it. Probably the other big thing is that this movie, the iconic fight scene that's going to go down between the Bats and the Supers, is heavily inspired by Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns, one of the iconic Batman comic books. And I'm thinking, is this going to carry on with regards to some of the other feels of the movies? It appears that we have a retired Batman, and Bruce Wayne decides to come back as the Batman after the devastation in Metropolis from that first Superman movie with Henry Cavill, perhaps inspired by the girl he rescues in the trailer, who I'm guessing is now an orphan. This is backed up by the outside shot of Wayne Manor completely in disrepair, so obviously he hasn't been to the Batcave for a while. Oh, and when he does go there, there's a little Joker reference as well, so could we be seeing the Joker making a cameo in this movie too? We'll have to wait and see. The rest of the going-ons seem pretty straightforward, except for a bit where Batman is being basically held at gunpoint by a group of soldiers with a Superman insignia on their shoulders. That I don't know about. I guess we'll have to find out more about that later. Next up, and probably I think the biggest from my point of view, is the Star Wars Force Awakens behind-the-scene reel that they showed at the con. Not too many reveals in this one. In fact, pretty much no reveals in this one. Well, maybe one small one. Get to that in a moment. The focus of this video really was that they are using real sets and as much practical effects, including the creatures, as possible. So, allegedly, not a Jar Jar Binks in sight. Thank God for that. There was a brief shot of a actress in the full performance caption type camera that you may see our good friend Andy Serkis in when you look at some of the behind the scenes filming of some of his motion capture performances. But beside that, there was very, very little focused on anything other than the practical side of things. They showed you the sets, they showed you the creature costumes, they showed you the constructed Millennium Falcon, they showed you a model of a crashed TIE fighter. All very, very pretty and lovely. I do get the feeling that there will be a bit more CGI than they're trying to let on, but here's hoping that the final movie will look as good as this teaser. Okay? Keep it going. And I also must say that I did like the appearance of Simon Pegg within this video. It soon became obvious that he is going to be fully costumed and pretty much unrecognizable in the movie, but you didn't get to see as what. So there's something else with a bit of air of mystery. And finally, there was the teaser for season 9 of Doctor Who starring Peter Capaldi. What can we say about this? In this very short teaser, you get to see Daleks, Cybermen, Zygons, Missy slash the Master, ghosts, and the Doctor shredding, apparently, at an electric guitar. There's also a mystery girl at the very, very end who obviously knows the Doctor. I'm going to put myself out there and say, I think that might be Susan, the Doctor's granddaughter who actually did get a mention in the last season. Coincidence? I think not. Beyond that, probably not much more you can add from this quick teaser. I will say, though, that the lines from the Doctor in this trailer, I think they could have done better. They don't really do it for me, but you know what? Doctor Who has continued to surprise me in the new season, so I will give it the benefit of the doubt, and I look forward to seeing that start up in about a month's time.
Every time I think it can get more extraordinary, it surprises me. It's impossible. I hate it. It's evil. It's astonishing. I want to kiss it to death.
On the 30th of July, we celebrate the 58th birthday of singer-songwriter Kate Bush. Gosh, I haven't mentioned Kate Bush for a while. Originally the discovery of Pink Floyd's Dave Gilmour, a lot of her demos made their way to EMI in the late 70s. She had her breakout single with Wuthering Heights, which, incidentally, is my favourite song of all time. Originally written off as perhaps a one-hit wonder, she managed to fill it out with many other sort of top 50 hits over the next two decades. She has always been somewhat of a cult artist out in Australia. Songs like Wuthering Heights, of course, Babushka, Running Up That Hill have all become Australian hits and classics of their era in their own right. Now, Kate's had a very interesting career. After the original debut album, The Kick Inside, charted so well off the back of Wuthering Heights. You then had Lionheart, which she rushed out within, I think, 10 or 11 months, which she was never quite happy with. It was this which fueled her to become her own producer, have her own studio, to work on her own terms, and it meant that everything from then on was very much experimental. She didn't see it as experimental, it was just very much cutting edge for the time. She discovered the Fairlight synthesizer through Peter Gabriel and used it to great effect on the Never Forever album, which featured the hit Babushka, and then even more so on The Dreaming in 1982. Incidentally, The Dreaming is my Desert Island album, possibly, or one of the greatest albums of all time, and it's probably Kate's I've Gone Mad album. So if you want to hear something a bit out there, and Kate in full reign, you know, as producer, songwriter, and singer, you have to hear The Dreaming. It's definitely out of this world. She followed that up with 1985's The Hounds of Love. Now, this has become sort of the one that she's most remembered for, the one that people have said, you know, one of the greatest, you know, albums of all time. It sort of brought her back into the charts again after the critical failure of The Dreaming in 1982. So she then moved on to The Sensual World in 1989, which had her doing more of a folky, Celtic sort of a sound. And then 1993, she did a complete sellout album, The Red Shoes, which featured very much her going for mainstream radio-friendly pop. And it was one of the only times she hit the charts in America, which was always so hard for her to make her way into it. But hey, even though they were radio-friendly hits, they managed to bring her to a wider audience. There was then, I think, over a 15-year break before she released Ariel in 2003. A double album, very much like The Hounds of Love, which had two sides. This one had a Sea of Honey and a Sky of Honey, one telling a story and the other being the more conventional, I suppose, singles. She then followed this up in 2011 with Director's Cut, where she went back to, you know, albums like The Sensual World and The Red Shoes and re-sang a lot of the songs. The reason for doing this is quite hard to know, but it got everyone quite interested in Kate again, and it paved the way for her next album, 50 Words of Snow, which was released in 2011 on my birthday. Kate made a triumphant return to the London stage in 2014 with her Before the Dawn tour. This featured a lot of hits, not Wuthering Heights, and a lot of songs off her new album, 50 Words of Snow. And it was the first time in over 39 years she had performed on the stage. So it was great to see Kate back in her element again. I was unable to get tickets, but I'm hoping that they do release a DVD. I definitely recommend, if you want to go and have a look, listen to Kate Bush, go back to The Dreaming from 1982. It's very much showing exactly the creative prowess and the talent that makes Kate Bush the artist that she was then and is today. So happy 58th birthday, Kate Bush, for the 30th of July.
No interview for the local wildlife section this time around, so I thought we could have a bit of fun and bring Christian back in for a bit of a chat. Now, I've already talked about some of the big sequels coming our way, those big Comic-Con reveals, but there's also a number of remakes heading our way, which range from interesting to downright terrifying. What are your thoughts on that, Christian?
Oh, gosh, on the list or the concept of remake? Gosh, I don't know where to start, Trevor. Look, you know, I know this is, you know, a list that I've sort of come across recently, and it's, you know, nowhere near as extensive as some of the other ones I've seen, but there's some really interesting title choices that are sticking out, and I don't know if these are things that have been sort of kicked around maybe in the last couple of months or a bit more recently. I don't want to defend a remake. To me, a remake is a way of appreciating the original film even more. That's how I always look at it. But I think if you are going to remake something, it's almost like taking it to a whole new time and place. You know, like we've looked at Attack of the 50-Foot Woman in Redeeming Features, and that was made in the 50s and then remade in the 90s, but they were able to put it into a whole different context. But a lot of these, you're looking at films that are barely even 20 years old, like The Craft from 1996, you know, that's 19 years old, and they're already looking to remake it. And you're sort of thinking, okay, are they trying to catch then that wave of people like myself that were into it in the 90s? It's sort of hard to see. But then you're sort of going back with War Games, with that had Matthew Broderick from 1983, and the thoughts of remaking that too. And it's almost too hard to imagine a different person in the role. But then sometimes when you're looking through this list, you're also seeing that these famous actors that were associated with the original are very cleverly associated with the remake. So I know we've got the new Ghostbusters movie coming out. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Trevor, that's more a sequel than a remake. I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, it's a reboot, I think, is the way that they were declaring that. But apparently it does, or that they intend to honour the original. So I think it's, yeah, the Ghostbusters franchise in a much more modern time, and, well, I'm trying to remain cautiously optimistic about that one.
Well, then, you know, just by you saying the word modern time, that's another thing about remakes. Like, they couldn't remake Rocky Horror now, because why wouldn't someone have a mobile phone in the car? You know, things like that, you now have to try and consider all that. Like, they remade Carrie last year.
Hang on.
You know,
I've got a line for that Rocky Horror thing about the mobile phone.
Yes?
Damn it! I knew I should have bought my car charger.
Perfect. Oh, my God. Because, you know, Trevor, that finds some way around it. That's what I was thinking. But you know, yeah, a lot of these films, you know, they remade Carrie last year, and you know, that it was all about, you know, them tormenting her at school using their smartphones and things like that. So, you know, they use a lot of things cleverly, sometimes really obviously. But then there's some films that you go, you know, I just don't know how they would work in a modern sort of time. They very much worked in the time they came out. You know, we've got Commando, which had its 30th anniversary recently. You know, Point Break, American Werewolf in London. You know, interesting ones like Logan's Run, which to me is so quintessentially 70s in its style, it would be really hard for them to remake it without it coming across just a real clunky CGI bore, you know. I don't know. But I think you kind of hit the nail on the head before, Trevor, with the word reboot. I think that's a lot of the way that they're going with a lot of these, with the fact that they're almost rebooting it so that it can then have another lot of films that can follow it. You know, you had Rob Zombie remake Halloween, you know, a few years ago, and he made Halloween 2. Here's me thinking, oh, great, I love the original Halloween 2 with Jamie Lee Curtis. No, it's not a remake of the original. It's a whole sequel to the reboot. So they kind of, then they create they're then creating their own universe again and kind of making these films, you know, last even longer. But, you know, nothing irks me more than when, you know, you screen Willy Wonka or Texas Chainsaw Massacre and people say, oh, which one is it? You know, nothing irks me more. And I can see, you know, in 20 years' time or even more, we'll be turning around and going, oh, you know, was it the 2010 version, the 2020 version, or the 2030 version of that film? So I'm kind of dreading it in some way. So, and, you know, to second what you said, very apprehensive about the Ghostbusters reboot as well. So,
well, I know if it's a Christian Fletcher screening, it'll be the original.
Oh, definitely. I think there's been a couple of times, you know, but hey, I think I showed the remake of The Blob. But hey, it's an 80s movie. Some things you can just go, okay, tongue firmly in cheek, I think. So,
yeah. Mind you, that was, I did like that remake of The Blob because it did have that, it did actually lead up to the thing where the blob comes out of the movie screen, which I thought was a very nice touch in a remake of a movie.
And that was actually something like, even though the original Blob is so iconic, it's actually a movie that's very, very dialogue driven and not much really happened, so it felt good that they actually turned it into a full-blown 80s horror movie. And hey, it did very well for me at the box office, so I can't begrudge the film. But yeah, so there, in that respect, see how I've gone, wow, it works even as an 80s remake. So some of these films may work, some of them may not, but going back to what I said before, if it makes you appreciate the original even more and brings attention to the original for newer fans, you know, I honestly think, you know, that's the best way to look at a remake.
Most remakes, I think, approach it with cautious optimism. Most of them usually do give themselves away in the lead-up if they're going to end up being pretty terrible. So it can be pretty easy to wean those ones out.
Yeah, and you've usually, they either fall into two camps. You've got the one that's just trying so hard to be almost the original, you know, so much, or the one that's just gone completely out there and just changed as much. I don't know if you saw the recent Annie, because they've changed a movie more to try and cater to a modern audience. But, you know, we are living in the future now, so it would be interesting to see how they bring technology and a lot of these other elements into a, you know, a modern day, into 2016 or whatever these movies are due for release. So I know I saw a list recently of probably, you know, 150 horror films that are being remade. And, you know, and that just made me go, well, obviously there's a real a thirst for blood, I suppose, for moviegoers. So, you know, it's, hey, more stuff to release at Halloween time. So, and I know the cinemas are desperate. I got a email today to say that, you know, that all the local cinemas will be screening all the cult classics again from now until December. So when I'm seeing that, I'm knowing that cinemas are struggling.
Yes, indeed. Anyway, with regards to remakes, if anybody out there has a remake that they're looking forward to or particularly dreading, of course, we will be listing all the ways you can get in touch with us at the end of this podcast, and we'd love to hear your thoughts and what you're looking forward to. Personally, I am cautiously optimistic about Ghostbusters. Even though it's more a sequel than a remake, the upcoming Zoolander sequel I'm very keen on seeing. But for some reason, even though it's meant to be getting the originals back, the Bill and Ted reboot / sequel, they can't seem to quite make up their mind, and that definitely has me worried.
Oh, and I think, you know, Trevor, as soon as you're saying the names associated with the two, and, you know, I mean, sorry, the original movies, you know, having Keanu Reeves and Ben Stiller for Zoolander, you think, ooh, is this sort of at a bad time in their careers when they're going, gosh, let's go back to one of my hits and remake it or make a sequel? So it's really quite interesting when you realise the talent involved too. Mm.
Is there anything in particular that you're looking forward to or particularly dreading?
Well, I don't know, in terms of, like, there's definitely a lot that I'm dreading. I know I've been waiting quite a lot for Suspiria, which was quite a bit of a culty Italian horror film from the 70s with Jessica Harper in it. And they've been talking for a while about remaking that. Another one is The Birds, the Alfred Hitchcock film. Not that I'm looking forward to it, more that I'm looking forward to seeing how they'll tackle it. Will it become a CGI mess or just fall flat like Birdemic? So I think in terms of looking forward to things, I think Jumanji, they could do something really quite cool and quirky with something like that. Even though the original, you know, again, you know, why do they bother remaking this? And things like too, American Werewolf in London, you know, with the special effects and the makeup and the things that they can achieve nowadays, it would be really interesting to see. So there's a couple there, but they definitely do not weigh out the ones I am not looking forward to.
Cool. Thank you, Christian.
Thanks, Trevor.
The winter events just keep on coming, and I'm really excited to bring back Hercules in New York, Arnold Schwarzenegger's first movie. We included the film last year in our redeeming features section. However, this year I'm bringing it back to the big screen for Arnold Schwarzenegger's birthday on the 29th of July. Screening at 6:30 p.m, I'll have my sidekick Kelly with me, and we will be doing a pre-show trivia quiz, and $10 tickets gets you the movie and complimentary popcorn on arrival. So come along for a trash movie night, and hey, it's the 1969 movie that Arnold Schwarzenegger would prefer you to forget. Let's go back and revisit a trash classic. This is at New Globe Theatre on the 29th of July. Get ready to save Ferris. I'm so excited to be bringing Ferris Bueller's Day Off to the big screen for the first time in 15 years. I've never been able to get the rights until now, and I'm so excited to be getting the film direct from Paramount, who will be giving us a newly remastered version of the film, and you've never seen it like this before. Come along and spend the day off with Ferris Bueller as it screens on Friday the 7th of August at Chanel Theatre, University of Queensland, St. Lucia. Before and after the movie, we will have a DJ playing 80s music, so get into the mood, get dressed up, and hey, there's even a prize for the best dressed, and the theme, high school uniform. Tickets are available at the door, as we are located in the small licensed cinema downstairs. This is an intimate screening, so I do probably recommend pre-booking, and tickets are $15 plus booking fee per person. Tickets are available through my website, which I will mention at the end. Coming up on the 15th of August is the 10th annual Brisbane Madonna Party. Australia's longest running Madonna Party celebrates the Queen of Pop's birthday, and in recent news, the upcoming Rebel Heart Tour. To get you in the mood for the concert in March, why not head along to the New Globe Theatre, where from 6 o'clock till midnight we'll be playing all of your favourite Madonna hits from the 80s, 90s, noughties and now. Over 30 years of classic hits on the dance floor with some of Australia's most passionate fans. Tickets are available at the door for $20 per person. However, I definitely recommend pre-booking, $15 plus booking fee per person, and they are available through ticketbooth.com.au and are selling fast. I look forward to striking a pose and getting into the groove with you on the 15th of August. For full details about upcoming events and to book tickets, visit www.christianfletcher.com. I look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you so much for listening to The Rufus Project. We hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as we enjoyed putting it together. Now, if you have any comments, feedbacks, requests, suggestions, do you agree with what we said? Do you disagree with something we said? Then let us know. You can easily find The Rufus Project on Twitter or Facebook, or even head to our homepage, therufusproject.podomatic.com, and leave a comment below this very episode. Feel free to also leave us a review on iTunes if you're so inclined. You can also show your support by heading to our t-shirt store, therufusproject.printup.com.au, and picking up one of our original designs. Trust me, there's something there for everyone. We're also looking for anyone who might like to be featured in our local wildlife section. This could be yourself as a performer or artist, whatever, or maybe you're involved with some event that you would like to discuss in greater detail. We would love to hear from you. You can also email us at therufusproject@gmail.com if you don't want to use any of the more open social media options. Also, don't forget to download next week's Redeeming Features cast, where Christian and I attempt to redeem the 2001 bomb featuring Mariah Carey, Glitter. Here's a little taste of what to expect.
In a world where proving yourself is everything.
Hey, Billy, can you repeat that verse?
Okay. They don't matter. They're just backup.
One woman is about to get the chance.
All right, everybody, when the microphone comes, I want you to do something special.
To go from unknown.
You have got a beautiful voice.
I want to produce you.
Yeah, right.
To a world she's only dreamed of.
Don't you be getting all freaky on the first date.
I think it's safe to say that that one is a bit of a challenge when it comes to finding redeeming features. But again, more next week. Now finally, the moral of this podcast is, if you're going to release footage or a trailer at San Diego Comic-Con, then just release it on the net and don't worry. Then you don't need to worry about leaks or anything like that. DC, Suicide Squad, I'm looking at you guys. See you next time. Just as an addendum to our remake chat, Christian did mention that he was looking forward to the remake of Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. He listed his reasons, which are quite valid. I don't know if Christian didn't realise this at the time of recording, but the producer on that remake is Michael Bay. If anything makes me worried about the remake of The Birds being a horrendous atrocity that may well be a future redeeming features contender, is the fact that Michael Bay is involved. Well, I guess we can look forward to exploding seagull poop. Yay!